Good morning and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. Today is Monday, April 2nd, 2018. I'm Senator Mia Costello. I'd like to welcome Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Vice Chair Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Senator Machicki.
Good morning.
Senator Stevens is excused today. The time is 9:11. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Carrie. Appreciate it. And also our LIO operator, Jane. Welcome. Thank you. Today we have several bills on the agenda. Senate Bill 112, Senate Bill 38, Senate Bill 205, House Bill 79. We will not be hearing House Bill 170 today. We are still waiting for a committee substitute to be drafted. It's my intention this morning to move all of these bills. However, if there are issues that arise, perhaps we would decide as a committee to hold off for any questions. But with that, I want to welcome my aide, Natasha McClanahan. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we are first going to hear Senate Bill 112. This is the workers' compensation bill, and we have a committee substitute. Natasha will walk us through the changes, and then we will look to the will of the committee. So with that, Natasha.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. Natasha McClanahan for the record, and I'm going to be walking through the explanation of changes for the CS for Senate Bill 112, version L to S. Version S retains language that repeals and reenacts AS 2331-45 governing the award and payment of attorney fees. It retains language amending AS 2330-230A to provide a definition of independent contractor. It retains an applicability provision that states sections 1 through 2 of the Act apply to claims for injuries filed on or after the effective dates of those sections. And it establishes the Workers' Compensation Working Group in the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Division of Insurance, to review the state's workers' compensation system and provide recommendations to the legislature for reforming the system. The work group shall provide a report to the legislature by December 1st, 2018. And the work group is made up of the Commissioner of Commerce, the Commissioner of Labor, one member of the Medical Services Review Committee, one member of Organized Labor, one school district administrator, and two representatives of the state's business economy. All other sections of the bill were removed in version L.
Thank you, Natasha. I'd like to invite Senator Meyer to move the version that was just explained to us, and I will not object since we've heard the changes already. Senator Meyer.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 112, version S, as in Sam, to be adopted as our working document.
Thank you. Is there any objection from committee members to adopting this version? Thank you. So the committee substitute is before us as the working document. committee members, as we've heard, this bill retains two of the elements that came to us in the original version, or excuse me, the second version as introduced by the sponsor, and I worked with parties involved in this issue and realized that in order to get support for something of this nature, that it would be best to create a working group so that the parties can sit together and work out a version. The report to the legislature would be due December 1st, 2018, and then the committee would, the working group would disband on the last day of January in 2019. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I just would like to confirm my understanding about the attorney's fees. I believe it's fairly accurate to say that the attorneys for the employers or the insurance companies are often on retainer or have a monthly salary. And so for those individuals, the length of time that a case may take or how much it costs to defend or pursue a case is of no consequence directly to the attorneys, whereas the injured worker's attorney is very much impacted by this provision that limits what they can earn, and I think that the Section 1 would have the impact of making it more difficult for injured parties to, for injured workers to get representation.
Thank you, Senator Gardner. As this bill moves forward, there is a working group, and if the next committee of referral feels that there's any issues that need to be moved into that capacity, I'm sure that that committee can address that. It does go to Senate Finance next. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see this issue as a labor and commerce issue.
Are there any other questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none. Oh, Senator Meyer.
Madam Chair, I think my question is probably more finance question. So if you want to wait till this goes to finance to address. But on the fiscal note, it looks like we're going to add 24 full-time employees. Would we, you know, that's going to go to the Department of Administration, and they come from the Workers' Comp Division. So will we see a corresponding decrease from the Workers' Comp Division?
Natasha?
I believe that the section that spurred that fiscal note has been removed from this version of the bill, so I'd anticipate that to fall away.
So this isn't the correct fiscal note for this new bill. Is that what you're saying, this new committee substitute?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, is it possible to have the maybe we're going to do this, but have the sponsor of the bill comment on the committee substitute?
Senator Geisel, would you like to come forward and comment on the bill?
For the record, State Senator Kathy Geisel, Senate District N. I have no comment to make on this committee substitute that has been offered. I defer to the will of the committee. Thank you, Senator Meyer, through the chair.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Geisel. It appears like this is a compromise, and so that's what we have to do sometimes to keep a bill moving. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Meyer? Did you have additional questions?
No, I'm done. You're just way ahead of me here, Madam Chair. Okay, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 112, Version S, from the committee with individual recommendations, and so would it be forthcoming fiscal notes?
Yes.
Forthcoming fiscal notes.
Yeah, I'll object.
So we'll go for a roll call vote.
Senator Machicki.
Yes.
Senator Meyer.
Yes.
Senator Stevens. Absent. Senator Gardner.
No.
Senator Costello.
Yes.
3 yeas, 1 nay.
So with 3 yeas, 1 nay, Senate Bill 112, Version Sierra, moves from committee with forthcoming fiscal notes. So, next on our agenda, we have Senate Bill 38, Pharmacy Benefit Managers. We also have the sponsor here, also Senator Geisel. Thank you for being here this morning. My aide, Natasha McClanahan, will walk us through the committee substitute. And Senator Meyer, if you could move that committee substitute.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 38, Version D, Labor and Commerce, to be adopted as our working document.
And I'll object for the ability to hear the changes.
Through the chair, my name is Natasha McClanahan, staff to Senator Costello, and I'm going to walk through the explanation of changes for the CS for Senate Bill 38, Version A to D. Page 6, lines 22 through 25, changes language in relation to pharmacies' appeals of pharmacy benefit managers' reimbursements for multi-source generic drugs below pharmacy acquisition cost, in which a pharmacy benefits manager may grant a network pharmacy's appeal. It removes unrequired language that referenced a definition for the Board of Pharmacy. Page 9, line 6, updates language to correctly reference AS 2197-927, and it updates the effective date provision to reflect July 1, 2019.
And online, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the committee substitute. Is there any further objection to adopting this version? Okay, seeing none, the version is adopted. Online, we do have several individuals who are available in case there are questions. Justin Ruffage with the Soldotna Pro Pharmacy, Richard Holt, the chair of the Board of Pharmacy, Barry Christensen, the Alaska Pharmacists Association, and Catherine Kowalski with Petersburg Drug. Are there any questions of committee members or for committee of the committee members? Senator Machicki.
I'd be interested to hear from Mr. Holt about how he feels about the changes, if that's possible, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Mr. Holt, did you hear the question from Senator Machicki?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. The board is in support of Senate Bill 38, and so we appreciate you hearing and moving this bill this morning.
Senator Machicki.
Specifically on the changes, I was interested. I don't know if Mr. Holtz had a chance to review them, but I can also ask those questions in finance, Madam Chair.
Mr. Holt, I think Senator Machicki is interested in any specific comments related to the committee substitute before us.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, we are in approval of those changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to take a brief at ease. Commerce Committee is called back to order. I want to thank the individuals who made themselves available online. And with that, Senator Meyer.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 38, Version D, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection to moving the bill? Seeing none, Senate Bill 38 moves from committee with individual committee recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. We will take a brief at ease as we sign the documents, and thanks again to the sponsor and your staff for being here today. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Next on the agenda is Senate Bill 205, introduced by Senator Meyer, Vice Chair Senator Meyer, and his staff, Edra Morlidge, is here. Edra, if you could walk us through the explanation of changes after we move the committee substitute, and then also walk us through the sectional, and then we will probably hear next from Christine O'Connor, who is with the Alaska Telecom Association online. We also have several others available for questions. So with that, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 205U, as in uniform, Labor and Commerce version, be adopted as our working document.
And I'll go ahead and object for the sake of hearing the changes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Edra Morlidge, staff to Senator Meyer. There's four main changes in the committee substitute version U. First, it requires telecommunications utilities to continue to pay an annual regulatory cost charge to the RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Second, it requires the RCA to provide in their annual report to the legislature details pertaining to how much activity is spent on each area of telecommunication regulatory oversight. Third, it removes the exemption for AS 4205-145, which was the statute pertaining to telecommunications regulation policy and restrictions on regulation of telephone directories. And finally, it removes transition language that is no longer applicable. As far as the sectional analysis goes, if you wanted me to continue, or
actually, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection to adopting the committee substitute. Is there any further objection to adopting this version? Okay, seeing none. So we now have version uniform in front of us. Senator Gardner?
Thank you. Could you repeat your description of the third change?
Yes, that was actually, through the chair, Senator Gardner, that pertains to AS4205145, and it removes the exemption for telecommunications regulation policy and restriction on regulation of telephone directories. And I believe that was a section that you had a question about in a previous meeting.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Okay. Oh, Senator Machicki.
Do we have any idea? Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any idea what the cost of the new report might be? I mean, anything we ask them to do gets passed on to the ratepayers. Is that can someone describe sort of the additional information that's needed and how much effort that would be to provide that information?
Senator Machicki, if you don't mind, I think I'd like Edra to walk us through the sectional, and then perhaps Christine could respond to that if Edra's not able to, if that's okay.
Certainly.
Okay. Edra, if you would go ahead and walk us through the sectional.
Okay. For the record, again, Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. Section 1 deals with municipal powers and duties. This is a change that's needed because in Section 11, there's a repealer for AS4205810. Therefore, that is removed from reference in this section of statute. Section 2 is the Alaska Public Utilities Regulatory Act. AS4205141 adds two new subsections, excuse me, E and F, to the general powers and duties of the RCA. These subsections state that the commission may not designate a local exchange carrier or an inter-exchange carrier as the carrier of last resort, and that the commission may designate an eligible telecommunications carrier consistent with the federal code that allows for federal subsidies under the Universal Service Fund. Section 3 deals with the requirement of the annual report by the RCA. Section 4 amends AS4205254A that eliminated the regulatory cost charge. This section now maintains the current RCC funding mechanism of calculating and assessing the charge as it and applies it to all telecommunications companies. Sections 5 and 6 both relate to implementing the regulatory cost charge. Section 7 lists the sections that the telecommunications carriers will not be exempt from. And that's quite lengthy. I can read through them if you'd like me to, or I think you have. Would you like me to?
Could you?
Sure. So the first one is AS4205141F. That was a new section in the bill. Section AS4205221, requiring a certificate of public convenience and necessity. Section AS4205231, that's the provision for applying for the certificate. AS4205241, those are the conditions of issuing or a denial of a certificate. AS4205251 allows public utilities to obtain a permit for use of streets and municipalities. Section AS4205254 is the regulatory cost charge. AS4205261 prohibits a public utility from discontinuing or abandoning service for which a certificate has been issued. Section AS4205271 allows the RCA to amend, modify, suspend, or revoke a certificate. Section AS4205281, this prohibits a sale, lease, transfer, or inheritance of certificate without RCA permission. Section AS4205296, these are the requirements for providing telephone services for certain impaired subscribers. Section AS4205306 allows discounted rates for customers receiving benefits from a social services assistance program administered by either the state or federal government. Section AS4205631 allows a public utility to exercise the power of eminent domain. AS4205641 extends the RCA's jurisdiction to public utilities operating in a municipality. AS4205830 requires the RCA to establish exchange access charges to be paid by long-distance carriers to compensate local exchange carriers for the cost of originating and terminating long-distance services. Section AS4205850 relates to the administration of access charges by an exchange carrier association. Section AS4205840 allows the RCA to establish a universal service fund. Section AS4205860 prohibits a carrier from restricting the resale of telecommunications services. Moving on to Section 8, AS4205820, this is the section that deals with no municipal regulation and states, in addition to long-distance telephone company, the section amends AS4205820 to add local exchange carrier that is exempted in whole or in part from this chapter from being regulated by a municipality. Section 9 deals with definitions, including local exchange carrier, long-distance telephone company, and long-distance telephone service. Section 10 relates to the implementation of Section 4, the regulatory cost charge. And Section 11 are the repealers. It repeals the following provisions as the changing nature of the industry and market conditions have rendered them obsolete. And those are AS4205325, registration and regulation of alternate operator services, AS4205800, findings, and AS4205810, competition, which is deemed to be unnecessary in today's market. And if you would like more detailed information on any of those sections, as mentioned previously, we do have Christine O'Connor on the line, as well as some others, I think.
Thank you very much, Edra. So for committee members, I wanted to mention who we have online since you're not able to see this that I have in front of me. We have Christine O'Connor with the Alaska Telecom Association. We also have Kristen Schubert with the RCA, along with David Parrish with the RCA. We have James Jackson with GCI for any legal or drafting questions, along with Emily Nauman, the alleged legal drafter. And I want to publicly thank Emily for your commitment to the bills in this committee over the past few days. Really appreciate that. So are there any questions that committee members have? Senator Gardner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So my question, my first question, is on Section 4.
Senator Gardner, do you know who this is for? Your question?
I think for Christine.
Okay, thank you.
I think. So the description was that it remains cost charges and applies to all telecoms. Is that spreading of the cost charges, what kind of change is that?
Christine, if you could reply to Senator Gardner's question and also state your name and the association for the record.
Yes, thank you, Senator Costello. This is Christine O'Connor, Alaska Telecom Association. Through the chair, Senator Gardner, this is a change that is spreading the cost across a broader section of companies than it is today. Due to the age of these statutes, about half of the telecom companies in Alaska are not paying the RCC just because they've become exempt. So what this committee substitute would do is to cause all telecom companies to resume paying the RCC or the regulatory cost charge. So that is giving a broader base supporting the cost of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I guess they'll tell us when they hear about it. Madam Chair, I have another question, if I might.
Senator Gardner.
So in Section 7, we had a description of all the services for which a utility that provides telecommunications services is not exempt. but what are the ones that are actually being exempted? Just in common language, I don't need the numbers, but currently they're all of the sections apply to telecommunication services, and now a bunch of them and they're being exempted from, and just what are they?
Emily Nauman, are you able to reply to that question? It's, as you know, we state the sections of law that they are no longer, that they aren't exempt from. So the question then is, which sections are they, are the exemptions for?
Certainly. So this is, for the record, this is Emily Nauman with Legislative Legal Services. So through the chair to Senator Gardner, the answer to that question is not as straightforward as it would appear, and I would certainly be happy to do something in writing for you if you'd like to follow up with me. The challenge is that I wouldn't want to misstate which statutes apply. You know, all of the statutes other than the ones listed in the RCA statutes will apply, with the exception that some of those statutes are specific to certain types of utilities or certain types of behavior that a telecommunications company might never engage in. So really, without diving into each individual statute, it's difficult to tell you off the top of my head which ones will apply.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Maybe I can rephrase my question, and that is there any impact on consumers to exempting any of those provisions? Or are they just no longer relevant to this industry?
Through the chair to Senator Gardner, I probably am not the best person to answer that question. Someone from the RCA might have a better idea of the impact to consumers.
Thank you.
Senator Gardner, we do have Kristen Schubert and David Parrish with the RCA online.
Thank you. When we get to them, I'd like just sort of an idea of what it is we're exempting them from.
They're online for questions, so we could get to them now. Kristen, would you like to state your name and association for the record and reply to Senator Gardner?
I'll probably field this one. This is David Parrish with the Common Carrier Staff. Two of the big things that would that I see off the top of my head that would not be part of where the commission would be precluded from taking action over telecommunications carriers, obviously, is we wouldn't be able to assign an IXC or a LEC Kohler. We would, I think, lose much of our current jurisdiction over interconnection agreements, so disputes between carriers. They would no longer come to us, presumably. and then I think the other big thing would be that we would no longer exercise any economic jurisdiction over rate making for at least ostensibly several carriers across the state that have no active competition. That's both in LEC markets and in interexchange markets. So those, I think, would be the primary changes that you would see from a consumer impact standpoint. I guess I don't know that there would be negative effects right off the bat, but should a carrier ever want to raise their rates in a monopoly market, there wouldn't be the obligation to get those rates vetted and approved by the commission.
Thank you very much.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. If I can follow up on that question, Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
So, Mr. Parrish, if I understand, this bill only pertains to landlines, which I'm not sure exactly how many people still have landlines, but it's declining every year. I am correct when I say that, right? It just pertains to the landlines.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And do you know what percent of people still have landlines?
Off the top of my head, I don't. I would imagine that it varies across the state, but I think there's been numbers that suggest that I think that the take rate is below 50%. Is that correct, Jeff?
could be.
Yeah, I'd have to do a little more research to get a precise number, but you are correct in your understanding that there's a steady decline. I think, especially with residential use, I think business lines tend to businesses tend to keep their lines longer. I think it's part of their business model. They kind of need a landline. So I think that the rate of landline drops for business use is probably a lot shallower than residential. But your general notion that there is a steady erosion on landline use is correct.
And Senator Meyer, this is Stephen McAlpine through the chair. When the power goes down and the cell towers are no longer operable, if you don't have a landline, you can come to my house and make a call. I have two.
Okay, that's good to know. Thank you, Commissioner McAlpine. So, Commissioner McAlpine, since we have you on the line, may I, Madam Chair?
Senator Meyer.
On the line.
Or, yeah. since we have you on your landline. So you had raised some questions or concerns last time we heard this bill, and I know the various groups have been working with you, or at least working with trying to deal with some of your concerns. Has this new committee substitute addressed your concerns adequately?
Senator, through the chair, there's two, as Mr. Parrish indicated, really almost overriding issues. This is perhaps a classic example why we shouldn't watch sausage and legislation being made. I will say it is getting better, but this is the kind of bill that ought to be developed over time, and I would think that by next session we could have even a better result than what we have today. The two concerns that I have, David mentioned the loss of our ability to designate coalers, the carriers of last resort. My concern is, and we've had to face this issue, that a carrier just decides to stop service. And at that point, where do the customers go? Do they go to the FCC to complain? That's what's happening out in Natsu right now, where some of the customers have been cut off because they've been using the better system, and MTA has decided that they're no longer going to provide that service, and the consumers in that area, because MTA is deregulated, they don't have the ability to come to our consumer protection arm. They are going to the FCC. I can't say anything further about that because it is going to be a matter of scheduled on our public meeting on Wednesday. And just so you know, what one of our concerns is that carriers of last resort are currently receiving tens of millions of dollars in subsidy in competitive markets. For one, would like to see that money going into high-cost areas or even going into further development of VoIP or other kinds of telecommunications that could better serve the rural areas of Alaska. And then the second concern that David raised is the failure to agree on joint use or interconnection. So let's say we have a dispute between two carriers. Currently, what the statute provides is that the public utility would apply to the commission for an order requiring the interconnection. In other words, we would arbitrate those disputes. This has moved rapidly, and I came into the office on Saturday. I didn't pull this bill up, so I don't know when these changes were developed. With each hearing, it seems that we get a change, and certainly you go through this all the time. But this bill was laid on our desk without any prior notice, and as we've worked through it, you can see that there's been multiple concerns and multiple problems, many of which have been addressed. But I certainly would like to see a good bill come out at the end of the pipe rather than the one that is currently before you.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair, also, Commissioner McAlpine. I noticed that we've added a year-end annual report detailing the activity and costs associated. Is that a concern? Is that, I mean, I think that could be helpful to the legislature, but I don't know what that would require as far as adding to your workload.
Yeah, and Kristen actually works closely with the development of RCCs, and in that process we do calculate time that is dedicated to different activities. And I'm not sure if what is meant by that we should provide the legislature with detailed activity, whether that that indicates that we should discuss with the legislature exactly what the activity entails, in addition to the amount of time that's been devoted to any particular activity. If that's the case, it's certainly something we could do. It's just an item that would require more staff time, and on a daily basis, when people are keeping their time, they're going to have to, as a person who did make a living by timekeeping, I know that it takes time to fill out timesheets to the point that you generally have a paralegal or a secretary coming to you at the end of the day saying, be sure you do your time, because that's how we did business. And so I know that it can be very tedious, but at the same time, if that's something that the legislature wants, we can certainly do it, and with the understanding that it does take more manpower. Or probably not more manpower, that's not really accurate. It takes more time with the individuals that are involved in the timekeeping process.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner.
Pardon me.
Thank you. Section 8, and I don't know who's best qualified to answer this, says no municipal regulation, a long-distance telephone company, and it adds, or a local exchange carrier that's exempted in whole or in part may not be regulated. What is the potential impact of that specific provision?
I'll take a stab at that, I guess. This is David Parrish. Essentially, this is something that's already existing for long-distance or IXC carriers. I think this would just make it so that a municipality can't step in now that the RCA, at least under this bill, wouldn't have jurisdiction. So I think it's closing a potential for a municipality to step in the shoes of the RCA and start regulating any type of telecommunications carrier. That would be my understanding, but perhaps Christine would be better at explaining the intent behind
Thank
that
you.
Change.
Thank you, Christine. I think I may have inadvertently cut you off earlier. If there was something you wanted to reply to in an earlier question, please feel free, but also reply to Senator Gardner's question, and then we'll go on to Senator Machicki's questions.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Yes, first, Senator Gardner's question. Mr. Parrish summarized that correctly. It's just to ensure that in the future, a muni or a borough doesn't step in and try to impose regulation. And regarding a couple of the questions or issues that were discussed in the last couple of minutes, one, as far as local rate regulation, first, Senator Meyer's correct that
Christine?
Yes.
We are actually having some trouble understanding you, and I'm not sure, and the irony is not lost on us here, but if you don't mind either speaking up or closer to the phone, just and perhaps slowing down too, we're having a little bit of trouble with the connection.
Yes, my apologies. Thank you, Senator Costello. To Senator Gardner's question about the municipal regulation, David Parrish was correct in his summary that is just preventing in the future a municipal or a borough or some local entity from trying to step in and impose regulation on telecommunications. To the question earlier about landline adoption rates, The latest national figures I've seen show that only about 42% of households have landlines. However, that is an important, that's still important, and we are not proposing in any way to eliminate landlines or degrade that very important service. The local rates that Mr. Parrish mentioned are actually capped by federal regulations tied to federal funding. So the federal have regulations have a ceiling that companies, should they wish to raise those rates, which is not something that is happening today, even though most companies have the ability to do that without filing anything at the commission. A handful of companies do not have that flexibility. But they would be limited regardless by the federal rate ceiling. I'd also like to comment briefly on Chairman McAlpine's comments about the Kohler. That is, as we've said before, a duplicative obligation that is still continued under the certificate process. That is one of the listing that is not being exempted in the sectional analysis that Ms. Brakes went through. So the commission is currently looking at one situation, and they do have the, they are, I believe, looking into what authority and what the situation is regarding the technology involved. But they are still active in that, and this bill would not change that. It also, regarding the funds that companies are receiving to provide service, there is a docket that the RCA is actively pursuing how to change that, and commissioners and the chairman has stated from the dais many times their goals to reform that, and industry is actively participating and has submitted draft regulations, draft comments, and proposals to implement those changes. One last thing. On the report language, the intent there is less, it is just to ask that the annual report is formatted in a way that we can see the detail of the various types of telecommunication activity. It's intended to use the existing data already collected. What has happened over the years is the RCA's annual report format changes. And some years it's difficult to see exactly how much activity is attributed to each form of telecommunications. So we were not intending to suggest any additional data be collected, just that the presentation provides the similar detail, for example, as was provided in the fiscal year 2017 report, which I had put a graphic from that report in one of our earlier presentations that showed the number of filings being made by local companies, long-distance companies, and so on. I believe if there's any questions I haven't addressed, I'm happy to continue. Thank you, and I hope the reception here is coming through a little better.
Senator Gardner?
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Machicki?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of my questions have been answered. I do have one remaining, and that is, so this, the fiscal note still says that the regulatory cost charge would be removed for telecommunication services. I know that has changed. I know we'll have to get the fiscal note updated, but the last line of that fiscal note, if in the future the RCC funding mechanism is removed for telecommunications, doesn't that reduce the requirements or the workload of the RCA? What is the likelihood that that RCC would be passed on to other regulated utility sectors?
This is David Parrish. I think, if I understand the question correctly...
David, could you also mention you're with the RCA?
Yes. Sorry, yes, David Parrish with the RCA. I'm assuming that the question is referencing if the RCCs were eliminated for telecommunications companies. Can I get that clarified?
So that's we have two pieces of paper that are kind of battling with each other right now because we haven't had an updated fiscal note, but before the bill was amended, it eliminated the RCC for telecommunications services, and the fiscal note talked about that it could be shifted, which has been a concern of mine, to the other regulated utilities. So the question was, if you're no longer regulating, say that this progresses in the future to where the RCA does not regulate telecommunication, shouldn't that reduce your workload and avoid a cost shift to the other regulated utilities?
This is Kristen with the RCA. So in regard to shifting the RCCs to the other utilities, they're still going to be doing work on telecom, and so that burden is going to be shifted to the other utilities because the RCCs are calculated using labor ratios, and since we can't charge telecom RCCs, then that burden gets put on the other utilities, and so their charges will increase overall.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Michiki.
Okay, so since that has been removed in Section 4 now, it maintains the current RCC funding mechanism. Nothing will change, but I should just be on the lookout for a change in the future that could potentially unfairly shift that cost to other utilities. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions of committee members?
Sorry, can I follow in? This is David Parrish.
Of course, David, if you could just state your name and association again for those listening online.
David Parrish with the RC. This is David Parrish with the RCA. I just wanted to follow up on the change. This was something that the commission had addressed at the public meeting, the concern with the prior draft that Kristen had just noted. The current draft actually does improve from a fairness standpoint. One of the interesting things is when other utility sectors become deregulated, generally we have, the commission does no work for them. In telecommunications, it's a strange beast in that we still have lots of federal interplay. And so we have lots of delegated authority from the FCC to provide ongoing regulation, even of deregulated carriers. And so the fact that it would, bring back a requirement to pay some of those costs by otherwise economically deregulated entities that we do regulatory work for, that would be an improvement over the current, landscape. And that's all I wanted to add.
Thank you. Yes, and who is speaking, please?
This is Christine.
Oh, Christine, yes. If you'd like to comment, please feel free. And if you could, again, state your name and association for the record for those listening online.
Christine O'Connor, Alaska Telecom Association. We do have our legal expert online who can speak to the concerns raised about interconnection disputes, if that would be of interest to the committee.
Mr. Jackson, would you be interested in responding to the previous question?
Chairman, I would, if possible. Yes, I would, Chairman, if possible. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and state your name and association for the record, and then go ahead and proceed with your remarks.
Thank you, and please let me know if I'm not coming through. My name is James Jackson. I'm an attorney for GCI. I have been working with Christine and the Telephone Association on this bill and doing some of the drafting and then working with the legislative drafter. I listened to Chairman McAlpine and Mr. Parrish. I'm not exactly sure what raised their issue regarding joint use and interconnection, I don't think anything in the statute, in the draft bill, has changed in this regard. But I think is some confusion because the statute is really sort of confusing on this issue. The section on joint use and interconnection are 4205.311 and 4205.321. And it's true that those are not listed as sections which will still apply to us. But that is because this statute is somewhat strange in that it is stated within those sections that they still apply to utilities that are exempt under 4205.711. So specifically, 4205.321, which is entitled Failure to Agree Upon Joint Use or Interconnection, and which gives the commission the authority to resolve those disputes, in subsection D of 4205.321, it says this section and 4205.311 apply to all utilities whether or not they're exempt from other regulation under 4205.711. And since the exemption that this bill grants is under 4205.711, that section on joint use will still apply.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. That was quite helpful. Are there further questions of Mr. Jackson? No questions.
No.
Okay. So it is my intention to hold this bill. I appreciate those individuals online who've made themselves available. And with that, we will take a brief at ease as we get ready for the next bill. Labor and Commerce Committee. Next on our agenda is House Bill 79, Omnibus Workers' Compensation Bill. We have here with us Commissioner Dragas and Marie Marks. Welcome. If you could walk us through the bill and introduce it to the committee, and then we will open it up for public testimony. We do have individuals online for questions also. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for hearing HB 79 today. For the record, my name is Heidi Dragas. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. HB 79 will assist and improve the department's ability to administer the workers' compensation system. Last year, we presented the companion bill, SB 40, to this committee. Since then, HB 79 has made its way through the House, and it has seen some changes and some improvements along the way. HB 79 is titled an omnibus bill, but it really should be called an efficiencies bill. This bill focuses mainly on efficiencies. It modernizes our current workers' compensation system, which has not been significantly reformed in more than 10 years. This bill will speed up the resolution of disputes, improve the delivery of benefits to injured employees, deter workers' compensation fraud, reduce administrative costs, and provide adequate funding for the administration of the workers' compensation system. HB 79 was well vetted in the House, and it passed with the support of both minority and majority members. With me today is Marie Marks, who is the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and she will take you through the bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, for the record, my name is Marie Marks, and I'm the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. I just want to start, whenever I present on workers' compensation, I always like to start with the division's or department's mission. It's to ensure the quick, efficient, fair, and predictable delivery of benefits to injured workers at a reasonable cost to employers. Balancing these pillars is what guides the division's administration of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. As Commissioner Dragas stated, the governor's bill addresses all of the statutory pillars, but it especially focuses on the fairness, quickness, and efficiency of the workers' compensation process. Because the governor's bill, the workers' compensation efficiencies bill, is a large one, with changes made for each topic throughout the bill, I thought it would be more helpful for the committee members if instead of conducting and going through a sectional analysis by topic, do it by topic instead of numerical order. In presenting, we have found that it runs a little bit smoother that way. And I have each section listed by topic as we go through it, and I will also refer to page numbers. And we are working from HB 79 version N as an ANSI. So first, HB 79 simplifies and quickens the hearing process by letting the board schedule a hearing shortly after a claim is filed, instead of waiting for one of the parties to request a hearing, which sometimes can be many years down the road. That is sections 19 and 21, which is on page 10 of version N. It also changes who may represent a claimant in a workers' compensation hearing. Right now, non-attorneys may represent parties. The bill proposes that anyone authorized by regulation of the board may represent parties. And the reason is, currently right now, we have instances where non-attorneys who are not bound by ethical and professional rules represent parties before the board, such as someone's best friend or their spouse. And oftentimes, that person's assistance not only is it not helpful, it actually delays bringing things to a hearing and delays outcomes for injured workers. Through the process, initially this provision had said, well, non-attorneys just can't represent parties. But through the hearing process, it came to the division's attention. There may be some instances where you would want a non-attorney, maybe a retired attorney, to represent. And so instead of in statute listing out all those different instances, the result was, well, through the board and regulation, can get very specific and detailed about who may represent parties before the board. The next provision is that HB 79 streamlines settlement agreements by eliminating a requirement that the board approve attorney's fees as part of a settlement when fees are the only issue that requires board approval. The bill also streamlines the process of imposing civil penalties against uninsured employers by allowing the division to assess the penalty directly rather than petitioning the board to set the penalty. Of course, an employer who disputes the penalty may always challenge the assessment before the board. Currently, there's no language in the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act addressing if and when a provider's written request for medical care, a pre-authorization, and usually this is for surgeries. There's nothing requiring it to be accepted or denied. HB 79 requires an insurance company or a self-insured employer to pre-authorize or deny that request within 60 days. And the reason is this gap has led to a lot of litigation and really delayed the delivery of medical care to injured workers. And the last bullet point here just clarifies there's no change for other medical bills. Medical bills still must be paid in 30 days.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. It seems to me that if a person is injured and their care provider is recommending surgery, 60 days is an awfully long time to wait for needed surgery. Why is it so long?
I'll let the commissioner, I guess, address this one for the versus. Oh, you go ahead. Okay. And so currently under the law, the only duty that an employer has is when they receive a medical bill for care that has already taken place is to pay it within 30 days. By the time the medical bill is received by the self-insured employer, the insurance company, the care has already happened. They've already had the opportunity to have one of their doctors look at and evaluate the injured worker. It's a little bit different situation when you're asked to pre-authorize a surgery. And generally, we're talking about very expensive surgery, such as a back surgery. It's a little bit different. 60 days would give the employer or the insurance company time to send the injured worker to a physician of their choice if they want, and also get the medical records from the doctors. As you know, doctors providing medical records for to parties is not a high priority sometimes for them. It's to take care of people. It's really hard to get a doctor to provide medical records even in 45 days. And so 60 days would allow that to happen while still requiring the employer to say yes or no. What happens right now is an injured worker needs a back surgery. And the doctor says, I'm not going to move forward with this if I don't know how I'm getting paid. So either injured worker, you confirm you're going to pay this if it's found not to be work-related, or insurance company, I went in writing your pre-authorization request, you're going to pay it. But the doctors were reluctant to move forward with the surgery. injured worker says, I don't want to move forward if I'm going to be on the hook for this. I'd rather live with my pain rather than think that I'm going to have $10,000 surgery bill. And the insurance company says, my duty under the act right now is you send me the bill and we'll pay it. And we'll tell you within 30 days whether we pay it or not. So looking back at the pillars as a balance. And the 60 days was essentially a compromise on that balance, to balance the injured worker's need for care and efficiency with reasonable cost to the employer.
Thank you.
The next sections deal with misclassification. The division is committed to addressing misclassification on behalf of both workers and law-abiding businesses. We are doing a great disservice to both when we do not tackle this issue head on. When workers are fraudulently misclassified, workers die or are severely injured, and huge uninsured losses can put a company out of business. I just want to clarify that HB 79 does not prevent legitimate bona fide independent contractors from operating and flourishing. They can and do. It does add a definition of independent contractor, which I'll go ahead and touch in here forward. But we must keep workers safe, and law-abiding employers should not have to pay the price for misclassification. So with that in mind, HB 79 strengthens provisions to prevent workers' compensation fraud by defining misclassification and when that amounts to fraud under the Workers' Compensation Act. Additionally, right now there is no affirmative duty for an injured worker to report wages or wage loss benefits. If they're asked, they can't misrepresent that and say, no, I'm not receiving them if they are, but there is no affirmative duty to tell an insurance company or self-insured employer that they're receiving benefits, and this does impose an affirmative duty on the injured worker to report that. Currently, right now, that there's a loophole really for LLCs where members of LLCs escape liability for benefits and civil penalties. It's because the act was created when corporations were in existence, and no one foresaw the LLCs, and so part of the act closes that loophole and will make LLCs that operate without insurance liable just as the same as corporate officers for uninsured injuries and penalties. It also defines independent contractor, and this definition is the biggest change, I think, since you had heard SB 40. This definition of independent contractor was a result of working with many stakeholder groups had reached out to us who initially vehemently opposed the definition and what was in the bill originally. And through the process and working with them, came to a definition that everybody could live with. And I think it was a really good example of collaboration between all the stakeholder groups that had reached out to us and the department. And so the definition of the independent contractor is a really good place, and it will still accomplish the mission of preventing fraud and misclassification while also ensuring that bona fide independent contractors continue to operate and flourish. HB 79 also allows the Benefit Guarantee Fund, which is the injured worker fund, that's our injured worker fund, to file a lien for compensation and civil penalties. And the reason is this is oftentimes when the Benefit Guarantee Fund pays a claim, and they pay it if an employer does not carry insurance, the injured worker fund will step in and pay medical care, lost wages, and so forth. Then the fund has to turn around and get reimbursed from the uninsured employer. By the time that happens, the assets are gone, the uninsured employer's assets are gone. And so this would allow the fund to file a lien, just like an injured worker already has the right to do, to protect that money that would go into the injured worker fund so it's available in the future for other injured workers. HB 79 expands the division's ability to assess a civil penalty to include employers who are underinsured and because they have misclassified workers in a variety of ways. Right now, the division only has the ability to impose a penalty for failing to carry insurance whatsoever, but this would allow them to assess a penalty for those who have misrepresented the nature of their business or called staff, you know, administrative staff when they know that they were working on a roof and are actually, you know, doing construction and so forth. Significantly, it changes the calculation and maximum civil penalty for a failure to insure case. And this is a huge part of this legislation. The maximum penalty right now is $1,000 per employee per day. And this has resulted in astronomically high penalties. Penalties that employers, they can't pay and they don't pay. And this has had two unintended consequences. First, the calculation of these penalties, they don't survive appeal, and it has led to a lot of litigation. Second, employers, because it's based on the amount of penalty per day, those employers who don't keep records that they're required to on the number of employees they have are actually rewarded they for not keeping records, because it's up to the division to prove how many employees there were and what the penalty would be. And so the bill corrects these issues by setting a maximum penalty of 3 times the workers' compensation insurance premium the employer would have paid had it properly insured its employees. The calculation is simpler because it requires only the employer's overall payroll data, as if it had properly classified those employees, and then the division of insurance assigns risk rates for those. The new penalty will result in a reasonable deterrent that takes into account the employer's size, the nature of their business, and the financial gain that the employer realized by operating without paying in full or in part for workers' compensation insurance. Just to give you an example, we recently had an employer that was assessed a penalty. I think the total penalty was $2 million or so forth. The amount of premium that they didn't pay was about $1,000. And so the maximum under the new bill would have been anywhere from zero, but the maximum of $3,000 for that period of time. Our hope is that when you have penalties that are more in alignment with reality, the division will actually be able to collect more as well, because right now the employers look at that $2 million penalty and we never hear from them again, and there's no way they can pay it. So we are hopeful that the amount that is collected, and all these amounts for penalties that are collected, they go to the injured worker fund. That's where they go. They're not used for division operations. So the amount that is worked, the hope is more would be able to deposit into the injured worker fund. The penalties may not be suspended in full or in part. Of course, the board can always reduce a penalty, reverse a penalty. They just can't assess it and say, well, for this person, we're going to suspend a large portion of it. Right now, the board has been suspending penalties, and it's been very arbitrary, and it's hard for an employer to tell what may be suspended or what may not be suspended. It allows an employer to pay interest or to make a payment plan, so that ensures employers won't go out of business. So it does allow a payment plan, and interest will be set at the state rate. There's a bunch of provisions that reduce administrative costs. The first one of those is that an employer must pay benefits by check right now, or they face a penalty. Times have changed, and so to keep up with those changing times, HB 79 will say it doesn't prescribe a specific payment method. Employer can choose to pay by electronic deposit or other means. Currently, right now, it doesn't allow the division to mandate electronic filing, and in fact, one of our statutes provisions says you have to mail in a report of injury by a stamped envelope. Again, a lot of this is just updating it for the times to say, hey, the division can prescribe the filing format. We have pretty much moved to all electronic filing. We're almost virtually electronic. This will allow us just to kind of move the last few instances where things have to be done by paper to modernize that. And then another thing that has been updated and streamlined is there's a corporate executive officer opt-out for work comp coverage. And it's involves a lot of paperwork that has to be submitted, and our staff looks it over, and it's a very time-intensive process. And we're streamlining it, and we're going to say, listen, we don't need to do all that paperwork. We're going to make it easy. If you have at least a 10% ownership and interest, that's enough to say you are not an employee. You don't have to have workers' compensation coverage. And corporations has a great database that can be looked at to make that easy to verify.
Senator Machicki.
Just a brief question just on that change of the 10% ownership. Do you think that there'll be a significant shift, or do you think that's relatively close to with the division approval today? Is that relatively close? Is there some relationship between the 10% and who is being approved today for not being an employee?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, it'll be difficult to tell how many officers or LLC members would be then considered non-employees. I have to say that right now we have many corporate officers who have no ownership interest in the business and are added. And we have corporations that change that makeup of their officers every few months, depending on who comes and goes from the corporation. So my guess is that it would make sure that those who legitimately have an interest in the company are exempted, as I think that is the intent of the act. So it is ownership interest, 10% ownership interest.
Senator Machicki?
So it's just much more of a clear criteria than you had previously when the division was making the decision. Is that, is it, it seems to be more black and white. It's 10% or not. Would, could any, could a, is there another reason why a corporate executive could receive approval if they didn't own 10% or they didn't have a 10% ownership interest?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, to answer your first question, yes, it's very black and white, and that was the intent. It streamlines it and puts everybody on notice of what's required. In answer to your second question, no, this would be the way that you would be exempted from coverage.
Thank you.
Very clear.
Thank you.
That is the goal of HB 79. A lot of it is not a bill that deals with substantive benefits, unlike I know other bills that are out there. It really is an efficiencies bill, and how can we make this clearer for the public to know what's expected and streamline things. Other administrative efficiencies are currently the Medical Services Review Committee looks at different publications that it uses to incorporate in coming up with a medical fee schedule. Some of those medical those publications that the MSRC, the Medical Services Review Committee, can use in the future as amended versions. We just added some to the list of that. I just want to clarify, it doesn't change what the MSRC can or can't use. It's completely in the Medical Services Review Committee's purview to decide what publications to use or not use. All this does is if they decide to use one version, usually those medical documents are updated every January 1st. It would just allow them to publish a quick notice to the public saying, we've already decided to use this new code book. Just you're on notice, every January 1st, we're going to be using the most updated version. Again, it's more of, it's an efficiency, not a substantive issue. The next change is that there is currently no deadline for insurers to tell us when an employer has coverage or not. There is a deadline, but there's no consequence for not meeting that deadline. What happens is we think an employer doesn't have insurance. We have our division staff spend the time and resources investigating that, only to find out, no, there is a policy. It's sitting on someone's desk somewhere. And we looked into it and said, well, why is Alaska's policies at the bottom of the pile? And we're essentially, the answer is, those states that have some consequence, financial consequence for not timely reporting are at the top of the pile. Those states that don't are at the bottom of the pile. And so by granting a 30-day deadline instead of 10, 30 days to report to us, but also have a penalty if you're late, we hope that that will reduce the wasted efforts investigating failure to insure cases. The bill also phases out the second injury fund. This will save administrative costs for the department and reduce costs to employers, which are required to contribute to the fund. The fund's purpose is to encourage employers to hire or retain disabled individuals, but the fund's purpose is moot now with the passage with Americans with Disability Act and other laws that bar employment discrimination, because under the ADA, you cannot ask someone before you've offered the job, them the job, whether they have a pre-existing disability. Under the bill, the fund would not accept new claims, and the old claims would be phased out as they're paid. And about half the states have already phased out these funds because of the passage of the American with Disabilities Act. Eventually, the employer's contributions to the fund would gradually drop to zero as the claims are paid. And just a reminder, these claims are for permanent total disability, about 95% of them, so they're paid for the life of the claimant. So in our fiscal note, we've estimated that most claimants, the average age will be about 80 years old, and about two or three will be phased out each year as that liability is reduced. And then finally, Section 1 ensures adequate funding for the Workers' Safety and Compensation Administrative Account, called WISCA. We refer to that as WISCA. The WISCA balance is rapidly declining. In 2005, the Alaska Legislature established programs such as the Appeals Commission, the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, and the Workers' Compensation Fraud Unit. These programs are funded by WISCA, but there was no increase in the WISCA service fee rate to account for the increased cost to operate these programs. The bill allows the department to receive a greater percentage of the fee the insurers already pay. So the bill does not increase the service fee being collected from insurance companies. It only allocates more of that fee already being paid to the department. Right now, that amount goes to the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund, but that money, I think starting next year, will go to the general fund, be redirected to the general fund. It is a difference of about $1.8 million. But again, the money is collected on workers' compensation premiums for the dedicated purpose of workers' compensation and safety programs. And so we are asking for 2.5% of that. And I did ask the former director at the time, I said, you know, when this was established in 2000, why was it only 1.82? And the answer was, well, that's all the funding that was needed at the time. We didn't need more than that. But again, since that time, there's been more programs added with no increase in funding. The WSCA balance will have a shortfall in fiscal year 2020 if a change is not implemented. And that is our overview. Happy to answer any questions the committee members may have.
Are there questions of committee members? Senator Gardner, no? Okay. I'll go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 79. We have two individuals online, and if there's anyone here in Juneau, certainly you're welcome to testify. The first is Bronson Fry with the Painters Union Local 1959. Bronson?
Good morning. My name is Bronson Fry. I'm with the Painters Union Local 1959. Also was recently appointed by Governor Walker to the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 79, and the reason for that is that, unfortunately, a business model has taken root in the construction industry whereby unscrupulous contractors are requiring, as a condition of employment, that their workers go out and get business licenses and self-perform as so-called independent subcontractors. Now, these are not legitimate independent subcontractors. There is definitely a place for those in the construction industry. But what we're talking about here are situations where an entire crew of workers working on a singular job, on a singular project, are all classified as independent subcontractors. As an example, here in Anchorage, the Dena'ina Center had 13 so-called independent contractors working for the same company doing all the drywall finishing on that job. Now, because workers' compensation premiums are so high in the inherently dangerous construction industry, they can account for up to 30% of the labor cost. So when one of these unscrupulous contractors finds a way to misclassify his employees as independent contractors and no longer have to account for workers' compensation premiums or payroll taxes, he can lower his labor costs and, in doing so, give himself a huge competitive advantage in the bidding process against any honest, law-abiding employer. So ultimately, what this boils down to is a fairness in contracting issue. This is a business issue in that respect. Also, by adopting this business model, liability for injury at work is being shifted down onto the workers. So no one should wake up in the morning and worry that that is the day that they fall out of a lift or suffer some other catastrophic injury and that their family is going to go bankrupt because of it. Workers' compensation exists for a reason, and when dishonest construction employers would rather game the system and wager the life and well-being of their own employees against their company's profit, then something absolutely must be done. House Bill 79 addresses this by providing a multi-factor test for determining independent contractor status. Now, having the ability to make a clear determination of independent contractor status will reduce workers' compensation fraud, create fairness in contracting in the construction industry, and it will protect workers something I think we can all agree is a moral obligation of our society. So I am very much in support of House Bill 79, and I would respectfully encourage you to please move it out of committee today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Laura Bonner calling in from Anchorage. Laura, if you could provide your name and affiliation for the record.
Good morning. My name's Laura Bonner. I'm speaking for myself. I'm retired, and I wanted to testify today because my husband suffered a work-related injury that resulted in a disability. This was years ago. So I understand what, from the worker's family point of view, what this is about. I support House Bill 79 because it's better. It allows better and quicker access to medical care and quicker resolution of disputes. Both are really important to the injured worker and their families. They're not only dealing with the injuries, but also the stress of how to pay for the family bills, who will pay the doctor's bills, and who will do the things that the injured person can't do, like maybe shoveling the driveway or taking the kids to school if they can't drive. I'm also glad to see the language that defines an independent contractor and strengthening the fraud provisions for employers who try to cheat the system. That hurts other employers' ability to compete. It also takes advantage of a lot of the younger employees, younger people entering the workforce. And that would be unfair to them. I just want to add that I did serve a couple of different terms under two different governors on the Alaska Safety Advisory Board. So safety and injured workers have always been a concern of mine. I hope that you will pass this out of committee and I think it's a better bill than the bill that you passed out earlier this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you for serving on the board. Next, Don Etheridge here in Juneau. Good morning, Don.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Don Etheridge. I'm with the Alaska AFL-CIO. And we want to go on record as supporting HB 79. We think that any efficiencies that can be afforded to the workers' comp division needs to be done. It can help with cost. It can help with efficiencies. And we were also involved with the working group that worked on the independent contractor language, and we were happy with the way it came out. A lot of things that people look at in this bill, and I was one of them right up the front. So who cares if we can go to electronic stuff or whatever? Until I met Jerry Falcone, who I introduced to several of you. And when he starts telling me how difficult just getting his check is, he has to get out of his bed in his wheelchair, go out to the mailbox, get that check. Then he's got to take that check down to the bank and get it deposited. Whereas with this piece of legislation, the ability to just put that check into his account and he doesn't have to go to the bank to get all of that stuff done. And that don't sound like a lot to most of us, but when you're stuck in a wheelchair for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's a major thing. And I think we need to look at any kind of efficiencies and improvements that we can do for the injured worker. And thank you for your attention to this.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here in Juneau who wishes to testify on House Bill 79? Oh, okay.
Do we have time for questions again?
Go ahead and state your name and provide your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Chris Diamond. I live here in Juneau. I am an organizer for the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. We represent about 2,000 members here in Alaska. First of all, I think anytime you're making government more efficient, you're moving in the right direction. And as far as the independent contractor portion of this, I think this is long overdue reform. We have two projects that just finished up here in Juneau. One of them was about a $5 million project. It was a lot of concrete work, tilt-up panel work. And the majority of the people on this project were independent contractors. And part of being an independent contractor is you're not working as a cohesive group. And when you're doing concrete work like this, that is, you are working together. You're being provided with a lot of the tools and equipment needed. There's also some condominiums that were being built out in the Mendenhall Valley. These were pre-manufactured modules. And so when you are attaching these, you have to have a group of employees that are working to fly them in with the crane. You have taglines. You have the guys that are actually attaching these modules together and putting the building up. So I would ask that you please get this out of committee. This bill is long past due. It will protect workers' rights and safety, and it will keep contractors playing more fairly. You know, we have a lot of good contractors that abide by the rules, but this particular job out in the Mendenhall Valley, I spoke with the owner of the project, and he directly told me that he does independent contractors so he can avoid paying workers' comp taxes and other employee-related taxes. That sort of dishonesty hurts the people that play by the rules here in the state. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else here in Juneau who wishes to testify on House Bill 79? Or anyone else online? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is now closed. I'd like to invite Commissioner Drygas and Ms. Marks forward for a question from Senator Meyer and Senator Gardner. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you actually may have addressed this, and I was, hate to say it, maybe not paying attention, because I always pay attention.
It's workers' compensation.
Yeah, exactly. So on page 4, and it's really no big deal. It's more of a curiosity, I guess. It says, the current law says non-attorneys may represent parties. And then the change in Senate Bill or House Bill 79 is any person authorized by regulation of the board. So if I'm an injured worker and I feel like my cousin can help me best explain my situation, would this prohibit that now? I mean, not that that's a wise move, obviously, but if I wanted to do that, would I not be able to do that anymore?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, originally when the
bill was... If you could also state your name and affiliation, again, for those listening online.
Yes, for the record, Marie Marks, I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. The bill HB 79 would allow the board, through the regulatory process, to come up with really would be a list of those people that could represent parties before the board. And the reason this change was made is the board panel, and the board serves two functions. There's the board that makes regulation, and then there's the board that hears claims. And that's a three-member panel chaired by a staff member, attorney staff member, who's a Workers' Compensation Division employee, and then one lay member from industry and one lay member from labor. So every claim or comp claim is heard by this three-member hearing, and so or three-member panel. So when I refer to the board, that's what I mean. That hearing panel, I think they're in the best position to know what types of people should be able to represent claimants before them in hearings. And so what is envisioned is through the board as the regulatory function, go through, come up with a list, take public comment. Through the regulatory process, there would be well-vetted lists. Take lots of public comment. We always have public comment at every board meeting, but through the regulatory process, you'd also have an additional opportunity for comment to come up with a really flexible, I think, more defined list. And so we would hear from people and say, listen, does it make sense to have my cousin represent me at a hearing? What are the pros and cons? Anecdotally, I served as a hearing officer for workers' compensation for 6 years, and there were times where, I remember one time specifically, a spouse was representing another spouse at a hearing. and they were not on the same page. And it was very, it was really awkward, and it was very inefficient. And so, and oftentimes we have former workers' compensation claimants that, you know, try to represent parties, but they don't quite understand the law, or they don't know the ethical and professional duties that go with, you know, representing someone and missing time frames and what happens if you miss a deadline. Those types of things, I think, is appropriate for the Workers' Compensation Board to consider and take public comment on to decide who is appropriate to represent parties before the board as a hearing panel. And that's why the change was made.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. So are you recommending then that the names on this board would be attorneys primarily, or what type of people do you anticipate would be authorized by the board?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, so the Workers' Compensation Board, which is our 18-member board comprised of 9 labor members and 9 industry members, would come up with that list. I envision that it would be exceptions that attorneys who are licensed in Alaska, which is now, that's allowed now. If you're an attorney licensed to Alaska, you can represent a party. It may be that the board would decide if you're licensed outside of Alaska, that would be okay. Maybe you're a retired attorney. That potentially could be okay as well. A paralegal who is under the umbrella of a law firm that has malpractice insurance, you know, that envision that. The doctor's office, we don't require the surgeon to come. Their medical billing specialist could come. This is the type of nuances that it was more appropriate, thought to be more appropriate in regulation rather than in statute, where it would be really more of an inflexible list that's hard to change as times change. What those would be, that would be up for, I guess, that 18-member Workers' Compensation Board to decide what that list should be. But I think that's the kind of things that have come up in public comment. What about the paralegals who work for a law firm? What about the retired attorney?
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, so you would anticipate that this list would be pretty long?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I anticipate it would be.
Okay, thank you.
Very, very specific and detailed to provide clarity, but the goal is always to provide clarity to the parties.
Senator Meyer, I think you've made a good point on the record that we are hoping for some common sense and flexibility in this list, and with a board of that size, I think that's something that appreciate you putting on the record.
Okay,
so,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair, if I can add to that.
Commissioner Dreyfus.
Thank you. Heidi Dreyfus, Commissioner for the Department. Initially, our draft had said that non-attorneys would not be allowed to represent injured workers, and there were a lot of reasons for that. We found there's significant problems in the hearing process, delays, dilatory actions. When you're not an attorney, you don't swear an oath of office as you do as an attorney. Marie and I are both attorneys, and we both sworn an oath to uphold certain standards of professionalism and ethical standards. And when you're a non-attorney, like a cousin or an aunt or an uncle or a spouse, you don't have those requirements, and it's created a lot of problems. This is our compromise to try to find somewhere in the middle where we can meet, where it would make sense for non-attorneys to represent.
Senator Meyer?
I appreciate that. And I think you're really looking out for the injured worker and trying to get him or her the best representation possible. I appreciate that. I just, and I mean no disrespect, because not everybody likes politicians, but maybe not everybody likes lawyers. So that's why I wanted to make sure the list was diversified to give the injured worker a choice. So, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about Mr. Diamond's testimony, and he talked about two projects here in Juneau that were apparently using supposedly contract labor, but they really weren't. When you hear about something like this, do you have the resources to follow up and look into those particular projects?
Through the chair, this is Heidi Dreyfus, Commissioner. Senator Gardner, yes and no. Yes, we do have the resources right now. We have a workers' compensation fraud unit that investigates those claims. So whether the fraud unit is made aware of an issue or they investigate, they will visit businesses and handle matters on their own as well. If they hear about something, if they know about something, they will investigate it to find out whether these workers are true independent contractors or whether they are employees. Of course, right now, as it exists in the law, that test is really cumbersome and clunky and problematic, which is why we're changing it in the law. We do have the resources, like every department. We're strapped for cash. It's been difficult. We've been cut the last, 3-4 years now significantly. Next year, as Marie Marks testified at the end in fiscal year 2020, the WISCA funding is going to be depleted, which is why we have requested the additional funding from the into the WISCA account, as Marie testified at the end of her presentation.
Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was concerned with the same area Senator Meyer was, and I'm not sure that oaths define honesty. They just better clarify dishonesty in time. No reflection on the current two attorneys that are joining us today. But my concern is with Section 7, where we seem to be redefining a limited liability corporation. I'm not sure if this is the right place to do so in a workers' comp bill. Just interested in your comments. The prior section never mentioned an LLC in existing 2330.075, and it's not a subtle change. It's significant.
And for the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Through the chair, Senator Machicki, just to clarify, it doesn't redefine what an LLC is. Right now in the law, there is a loophole. And under the current Workers' Compensation Act, an employer must have workers' compensation insurance for its employees. If it doesn't, the employer and those in charge of the business are responsible for any uninsured claims right now. So those corporate officers or those people who had authority to insure the corporation, who run the corporation, are responsible currently right now for those claims. LLCs do not have the same liability. So those LLC members who run the corporation, even if it's one single member, completely escape the liability that corporations have for uninsured injuries. And so this levels the playing field. A lot of this bill is leveling the playing field. It levels the playing field for all those members. Just like corporations, they have limited liability. That's what a corporation is, except the statute says right now, except when you're running the business, and if you're in charge of getting that work comp insurance and you don't, you're going to be liable. That exists already. And we're just saying LLCs shouldn't be able to take advantage of a loophole. And it's a loophole that we've seen. And what happens is we have a member who starts an LLC. They run without workers' compensation insurance. They get fined for not having work comp insurance, and they have an uninsured injury. An employee gets hurt. They close up shop. They open up another LLC in a different name, and they run without workers' compensation insurance until an employee is injured and they get penalized. They close their business, and they open up shop. You think this is a rare occurrence, but it's happening, and there is a real need to close that loophole to protect injured workers, but also to protect those LLC owners that play by the rules, that are paying workers' compensation insurance and getting outbid by these companies that are intentionally or unintentionally using this loophole to escape liability and underbid under employers.
Senator Machicki.
So you have an interesting definition of not redefining liability for LLCs. I understand your intent. I would have rather it dealt with it in a section of law that defined what an LLC can do for having that limit of liability as opposed to eliminating the loophole here. I agree with your intent. That's not the direction I would have gone, because what you'll see is if I were in your shoes, then I would say that I can just continue to change the liability for LLCs in different sections of law as opposed to a criteria of what that category of corporation, where their liability would be released. Do you know what I mean? And you put it in a very specific section. Six of one, half dozen the other. I don't need an answer. It's okay. I'm just because I do believe that's something we have to deal with in more categorically, more comprehensively. And I hate to chip away one piece at a time of where corporations should have liability, and in some places they just don't.
Madam Chair, if I can respond just to that very quickly.
Commissioner Vargas.
Thank you. Senator Kaczynski, I think that's a an interesting point. The reason we put it there is simply to maintain consistency within our statute, since the corporate section is already in our statute. That's why we went ahead with the LLC there. So I can see what you're saying. I think it made sense. I think you could argue both sides of it. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have no questions. Do you want the bill moved? Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 79, version N as in Nancy, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection to moving CS for House Bill 79 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note? Okay, seeing none, so moved. And the committee will be meeting tomorrow at 1:30. On the agenda, we will have Senate Bill 76. So if there are any amendments, please get those to me as soon as possible, and bills previously heard. So with that, the committee is adjourned.